Holmberg, it's nice of you to offer, but I think we'll put that idea on the back burner for now. So, back to the case. Sonia.
According to Blomqvist, Zarachenko came here in 1976. As far as I can work out, there's only one person he could have gotten that information from.
Gunnar Bjork, said Anderson.
What has Bjork told us? Holmberg asked.
Not much. He says it's all classified and that he can't discuss anything without permission from his superiors.
And who are his superiors?
He won't say.
So what's going to happen to him?
I arrested him for violation of the prostitution laws. We have excellent documentation in Dag Svensson's notes. Ekstrom was upset, but since I had already filed a report, he could get himself into trouble if he closes the preliminary investigation, Anderson said.
I see. Violation of the prostitution laws. That might result in a fine of 10 times his daily income.
Probably. But we have him in the system and can call him in again for questioning.
But now we're getting a little too involved in Sappho's business. That might cause a bit of turbulence.
The problem is that none of this could have happened if Sappho weren't involved somehow. It's possible that Zarachenko really was a Russian spy who defected and was granted political asylum. It's also possible that he worked for Sappho as an expert or source or whatever title you want to give him, and that there was good reason to offer him a false identity and anonymity. But there are three problems. First, the investigation carried out in 1991 that led to Lisbeth Salander's being locked away was illegal. Second, Zarachenko's activities since then have nothing whatsoever to do with national security. Zarachenko is an ordinary gangster who's probably mixed up in several murders and other criminal activities. And third, there is no doubt that Lisbeth Salander was shot and buried alive on his property in Gossaberger.
Speaking of which, I'd really like to read the infamous report, said Holmberg.
Oblansky's face clouded over.
Yakker, this is how it is. Ekstrom laid claim to it on Friday, and when I asked for it back, he said he'd make me a copy, which he never did. Instead, he called me and said that he had spoken with the Prosecutor General and there was a problem. According to the PG, the top secret classification means that the report may not be disseminated or copied. The PG has called in all copies until the matter is investigated. Which meant that Sonia had to relinquish the copy she had, too. So we no longer have the report?
No.
Damn, said Holmberg. The whole thing stinks.
I know, said Boblansky.
Worst of all, it means that someone is acting against us and acting very quickly and efficiently. The report was what finally put us on the right track.
So we have to work out who's acting against us, said Holmberg.
Just a moment, said Modig. We also have Peter Teleborian. He contributed to our investigation by profiling Lisbeth Salander.
Exactly,
said Boblansky in a darker tone of voice.
And what did he say?
He was very concerned about her safety and wished her well. But when the discussion was over, he said she was lethally dangerous and might well resist arrest. We based a lot of our thinking on what he told us.
And he got Hans Faster all worked up, said Holmberg. Have we heard anything from Faster, by the way?
He took some time off, Boblansky replied curtly. The question now is how we should proceed.
They spent the next 2 hours discussing their options. The only practical decision they made was that Modig should return to Göteborg the next day to see whether Salander had anything to say. When they finally broke up, Modig and Anderson walked together down to the garage.
I was thinking, Anderson stopped.
Yes?
It's just that when we talked to Teleborian, you were the only one in the group who offered any opposition when he answered our questions.
Yes?
Well, good instincts, he said. Anderson was not known for handing out praise, and it was definitely the first time he had ever said anything positive or encouraging to Modig. He left her standing by her car in astonishment.
Chapter 5 Sunday, April 10th. Blomqvist had spent Saturday night with Berger. They lay in bed and talked through the details of the Zarachenko story. Blomqvist trusted Berger implicitly and was never for a second inhibited by the fact that she was going to be working for a rival paper. Nor had Berger any thought of taking the story with her. It was Millennium's scoop, even though she may have felt a certain frustration that she was not going to be the editor of that particular issue. It would have been a fine ending to her years at Millennium. They also discussed the future structure of the magazine. Berger was determined to retain her shares in Millennium and to remain on the board, even if she had no say over the magazine's contents. "Give me a few years at the Daily, and then, who knows, maybe I'll come back to Millennium before I retire," she said. And as for their own complicated relationship, why should it be any different? Except that, of course, they would not be meeting so often. It would be as it was in the 80s, before Millennium was founded, and when they worked in separate offices. "I imagine we'll have to book appointments with each other," Berger said with a faint smile. On Sunday morning they said a hasty goodbye before Berger drove home to her husband, Gregor Beckmann. After she was gone, Blomqvist called the hospital in Sahlgrenska and tried to get some information about Salander's condition. Nobody would tell him anything. So finally he called Inspector Erlander, who took pity on him and vouchsafed that, given the circumstances, Salander's condition was fair and the doctors were cautiously optimistic. He asked if he would be able to visit her. Erlander told him that Salander was officially under arrest and that the prosecutor would not allow any visitors, but in any case she was in no condition to be questioned. Erlander said he would call if her condition took a turn for the worse. When Blomqvist checked his mobile, he saw that he had 42 messages and texts, almost all of them from journalists. There had been wild speculation in the media after it was revealed that Blomqvist was the one who had found Salander and had probably saved her life. He was obviously closely connected with the development of events. He deleted all the messages from reporters and called his sister Annika to invite himself for Sunday lunch. Then he called Dragan Armansky, CEO of Milton Security, who was at his home in Lidingö.
"You certainly have a way with headlines," Armansky said.
"I tried to reach you earlier this week. I got a message that you were looking for me, but I just didn't have time."
"We've been doing our own investigation at Milton, and I understood from Holger Palmgren that you had some information. But it seems you were far ahead of us."
Blomqvist hesitated before he said, "Can I trust you?"
"How do you mean, exactly?"
"Are you on Salander's side or not? Can I believe that you want the best for her?"
"I'm her friend. Although, as you know, that's not necessarily the same thing as saying that she's my friend."
"I understand that. But what I'm asking is whether or not you're willing to put yourself in her corner and get into a pitched battle with her enemies."
"I'm on her side," he said.
"Can I share information with you and discuss things with you without the risk of your leaking it to the police or to anyone else?"
"I can't get involved in criminal activity," Armansky said.
"That's not what I'm asking."
"You can absolutely rely on me as long as you don't reveal that you're engaged in any sort of criminal activity."
"Good enough. We need to meet."
"I'm coming into the city this evening. Dinner?"
"I don't have time today, but I'd be grateful if we could meet tomorrow night. You and I and perhaps a few other people might need to sit down for a chat."
"You're welcome at Milton. Shall we say 6?
"One more thing. I'm seeing my sister, the lawyer Annika Giannini, later this morning. She's considering taking on Salander as a client, but she can't work for nothing. I can pay part of her fee out of my own pocket. Would Milton Security be willing to contribute?"
"That girl is going to need a damned good criminal lawyer. Your sister might not be the best choice, if you'll forgive me for saying so. I've already talked to Milton's chief lawyer, and he's looking into it. I was thinking of Peter Altin, or someone like that."
"That will be a mistake. Salander needs a totally different kind of legal support. You'll see what I mean when we talk. But would you be willing in principle to help?"
"I'd already decided that Milton ought to hire a lawyer for her.
Is that a yes or a no? I know what happened to her. I know roughly what's behind it all. And I have a strategy."
Armansky laughed.
"Okay, I'll listen to what you have to say. If I like it, I'm in."
Blomqvist kissed his sister on the cheek and immediately asked, "Are you going to be representing Lisbeth Salander?"
"I'm going to have to say no. You know I'm not a criminal lawyer. Even if she's acquitted of murder, there's going to be a long list of other charges. She's going to need someone with a completely different sort of clout and experience than I have."
"You're wrong. You're a lawyer, and you're a recognised authority in women's rights. In my considered view, you're precisely the lawyer she needs."
"Mikhail, I don't think you really appreciate what this involves.
It's a complex criminal case, not a straightforward case of sexual harassment or violence against a woman. If I take on her defence, it could turn out to be a disaster.
Blomqvist smiled.
You're missing the point. If she'd been charged with the murders of Dag and Mia, for example, I would have gone for the Silbersky type, or another of the heavy-duty criminal lawyers. But this trial is going to be about entirely different things.
I think you'd better explain.
They talked for almost 2 hours over sandwiches and coffee. By the time Mikhail had finished his account, Annika had been persuaded. Mikhail picked up his mobile and made another call to Inspector Erlander in Göteborg.
Hello, it's Blomqvist again.
I don't have any news on Salander, Erlander said, plainly irritated.
Which I assume is good news, but I actually have some news.
What's that?
Well, she now has a lawyer named Annika Giannini. She's with me right now, so I'll put her on.
Blomqvist handed the phone across the table.
My name is Annika Giannini, and I've signed on to represent Lisbeth Salander. I need to get in touch with my client so that she can approve me as her defence lawyer, and I need the phone number of the prosecutor.
As far as I know, Erlander said, a public defence lawyer has already been appointed.
That's nice to hear. Did anyone ask Lisbeth Salander her opinion?
Quite frankly, we haven't had the opportunity to speak with her yet. We hope to be able to do so tomorrow, if she's well enough.
Fine. Then I'll tell you here and now that until Fröken Salander says otherwise, you may regard me as her legal representative. You may not question her unless I am present. You can say hello to her and ask her whether she accepts me as her lawyer or not, but that is all. Is that understood?
Yes,
Erlander said with an audible sigh. He was not entirely sure what the letter of the law was on this point.
Our number one objective is to discover if she has any information as to where Ronald Niedermann might be. Is it okay to ask her about that, even if you're not present?
That's fine. You may ask her questions relating to the police hunt for Niedermann, but you may not ask her any questions relating to any possible charges against her. Agreed?
I think so, yes.
Inspector Erlander got up from his desk and went upstairs to tell the preliminary investigation leader Agneta Jervas about his conversation with Giannini.
She was obviously hired by Blomqvist. I can't believe Salander knows anything about it.
Giannini works in women's rights. I heard her lecture once. She's sharp, but completely unsuitable for this case.
It's up to Salander to decide.
I might have to contest the decision in court. For the girl's own sake, she has to have a proper defence, and not some celebrity chasing headlines. Salander has also been declared legally incompetent. I don't know whether that affects things.
What should we do?
Jervas thought for a moment.
This is a complete mess. I don't know who's going to be in charge of this case, or if it'll be transferred to Ekström in Stockholm. In any case, she has to have a lawyer. Okay. Ask her if she wants Giannini.
When Blomqvist got home at 5 in the afternoon, he turned on his iBook and took up the thread of the text he had begun writing at the hotel in Göteborg. When he had worked for 7 straight hours, he had identified the most glaring holes in the story. There was still much research to be done. One question he could not answer, based on the existing documentation, was who in Seppo, apart from Gunnar Björk, had conspired to lock Salander away in the asylum. Nor had he gotten to the heart of the relationship between Björk and the psychiatrist Peter Teleborian. Finally, he shut down the computer and went to bed. He felt as soon as he lay down that for the first time in weeks he could relax and sleep peacefully. The story was under control. No matter how many questions remained unanswered, he already had enough material to set off a landslide of headlines. Late as it was, he picked up the telephone to call Berger and update her, and then he remembered that she had left Millennium. Suddenly, he found it difficult to sleep. A man carrying a brown briefcase stepped carefully down from the 7:30 p.m. train at Stockholm Central Station. He stood for a moment in the sea of travellers getting his bearings. He had started out from Laholm just after 8 in the morning. He stopped in Göteborg to have lunch with an old friend, before resuming his journey to Stockholm. He had not been to Stockholm for 2 years. In fact, he had not planned to visit the capital ever again. Even though he had lived there for large parts of his working life, he always felt a little out of place in Stockholm,
a feeling that had grown stronger with every visit he made since his retirement. He walked slowly through the station, bought the evening papers and two bananas at Presbyron, and paused to watch two Muslim women in veils hurry past him. He had nothing against women in veils, but he was bothered by the fact that they had to dress like that in the middle of Stockholm. In his opinion, Somalia was a much better place for that sort of attire. He walked the 300 yards to Frey's Hotel, next to the old post office on Vasagarten. That was where he had stayed on previous visits. The hotel was centrally located and clean, and it was inexpensive, which was a factor since he was paying for the journey himself. He had reserved the room the day before and presented himself as Evert Gulberg. When he got up to the room, he went straight to the bathroom. He had reached the age when he had to use the toilet rather often. It had been several years since he had slept through a whole night. When he had finished, he took off his hat, a narrow-brimmed, dark-green English felt hat, and loosened his tie. He was 6 feet tall and weighed 150 pounds, which meant he was thin and wiry. He wore a houndstooth jacket and dark grey trousers. He opened the brown briefcase and unpacked two shirts, a second tie and underwear, which he arranged in the chest of drawers. Then he hung his overcoat and jacket in the wardrobe behind the door. It was too early to go to bed. It was too late to bother going for an evening walk, something he might not enjoy in any case. He sat down in the obligatory chair in the hotel room and looked around. He switched on the TV and muted the volume. He thought about calling reception and ordering coffee, but decided it was too late. Instead, he opened the minibar, poured a miniature bottle of Johnny Walker into a glass, and added very little water. He opened the evening papers and read everything that had been written that day about the search for Ronald Niedermann and the case of Lisbeth Salander. After a while, he took out a leather-bound notebook and made some notes. Gulberg, formerly senior administrative officer at the security police, was now 78 years old and had been retired for 13 years. But intelligence officers never really retire. They just slip into the shadows. After the war, when Gulberg was 19 years old, he had joined the Navy. He did his military service first as an officer cadet and was then accepted for officer training. But instead of the usual assignment at sea that he had anticipated, he was sent to Karlskrona as a signal tracker in the Navy's intelligence service. He had no difficulty with the work, which was mostly figuring out what was going on the other side of the Baltic. But he found it dull and uninteresting. Through the service's language school, however, he did learn Russian and Polish. These linguistic skills were one of the reasons he was recruited by the security police in 1950, during the time when the impeccably mannered Georg Tulin was head of the 3rd Division of SEPO. When Gulberg started, the total budget of the secret police was 2.7 million kroner for a staff of 96 people. When he formally retired in 1992, the budget of the security police was in excess of 350 million kroner, and he had no idea how many employees the firm had. Gulberg had spent his life on His Majesty's Secret Service, or perhaps more accurately, in the Secret Service of the Social Democratic Welfare State, which was an irony, since he had faithfully voted for the moderates in one election after another, except in 1991, when he deliberately voted against the moderates because he believed that Carl Bildt was a realpolitik catastrophe. He had voted instead for Ingvar Carlsson. The years of Sweden's best government had also confirmed his worst fears. The moderate government had come to power when the Soviet Union was collapsing, and in his opinion no government had been less prepared to meet the new political opportunities emerging in the East, or to make use of the art of espionage. On the contrary, the Bildt government had cut back the Soviet desk for financial reasons, and had at the same time gotten themselves involved in the international mess in Bosnia and Serbia, as if Serbia could ever threaten Sweden. The result was that a fabulous opportunity to plant long-term informants in Moscow had been lost. Someday, when relations would once again worsen, which according to Gulberg was inevitable, absurd demands would be made on the security police and the military intelligence service, as if they could wave a magic wand and produce agents on demand. Gulberg had been at the Russia desk of the 3rd Division of the State Police, and after 2 years in the job had undertaken his first tentative field work in 1952 and 1953 as an Air Force attaché with the rank of captain at the embassy in Moscow. Strangely enough, he was following in the footsteps of another well-known spy. Some years earlier, that post had been occupied by the notorious Colonel Stig Wennerström. Back in Sweden, Goldberg had worked in counter-espionage, and 10 years later he was one of the younger security police officers who, working under Otto Danielsson, exposed Wennerström and eventually got him a life sentence for treason at Långholmen prison. When the security police was reorganized under Per Gunnar Winge in 1964 and became the security division of the National Police Board, or Swedish International Security, SIS, the major increase in personnel began. By then, Goldberg had worked at the security police for 14 years and had become one of its trusted veterans. Goldberg had never used the designation SEPO for Säkerhetspolisen, the security police. He used the term SIS in official contexts, and among colleagues he would also refer to the company, or the firm, or merely the division, but never SEPO. The reason was simple. The firm's most important task for many years was so-called personnel control, that is, the investigation and registration of Swedish citizens who might be suspected of harbouring communist or subversive views. Within the firm, the terms communist and traitor were synonymous. The later conventional use of the term SEPO was actually something that the potentially subversive communist publication Clarté had coined as a pejorative name for the communist hunters within the police force. For the life of him, Goldberg could never imagine why his former boss P.G. Winge had titled his memoirs SEPO Chief 1962-1970. It was the reorganization of 1964 that had shaped Goldberg's future career. The designation SIS indicated that the secret state police had been transformed into what was described in the memos from the Justice Department as a modern police organization. This involved recruiting new personnel and continual problems breaking them in. In this expanding organization, the enemy was presented with dramatically improved opportunities to place agents within the division. This meant, in turn, that internal security had to be intensified. The security police could no longer be a club of former officers where everyone knew everyone else, and where the most common qualification for a new recruit was that his father was, or had been, an officer. In 1963, Goldberg was transferred from counter-espionage to personnel control, a role that took on added significance in the wake of Wennerström's exposure as a double agent. During that period, the foundation was laid for the Registry of Political Opinions, a list which, towards the end of the 60s, amounted to around 300,000 Swedish citizens who were believed to harbour undesirable political sympathies. Checking the backgrounds of Swedish citizens was one thing, but the crucial question was how security control within SIS itself would be implemented. The Wennerström debacle had given rise to an avalanche of dilemmas within the security police. If a colonel on the defence staff, he was also the government's advisor on matters involving nuclear weapons and security policy, could work for the Russians, it followed that the Russians might have an equally senior agent within the security police. Who would guarantee that the top ranks and middle management at the firm were not working for the Russians? Who, in short, was going to spy on the spies? In August 1964, Goldberg was summoned to an afternoon meeting with the assistant chief of the security police, Hans-Wilhelm Franke. The other participants at the meeting were two individuals from the top echelon of the firm, the assistant head of secretariat and the head of budget. Before the day was over, Goldberg had been appointed head of a newly created division with the working title of the Special Section. The first thing he did was to rename it Special Analysis. That held for a few minutes, until the head of budget pointed out that SA was not much better than SS. The organization's final name became the Section for Special Analysis, the SSA, and in daily parlance, the Section, to differentiate it from the division or the firm, which referred to the security police as a whole. The Section was Franke's idea. He called it the Last Line of Defence, an ultra-secret unit that was given strategic positions within the firm, but which was invisible. It was never referred to in writing, even in budget memoranda, and therefore could not be infiltrated. Its task was to watch over national security. Franke had the authority to make it happen. He needed the budget chief and the secretariat chief to create the hidden substructure, but they were old colleagues, friends from dozens of skirmishes with the enemy. During the first year, the section consisted of Gulberg and three hand-picked colleagues. Over the next 10 years, it grew to include no more than 11 people, of whom two were administrative secretaries of the old school and the remainder were professional spy hunters. It was a structure with only two ranks. Gulberg was the chief. He would ordinarily meet each member of his team every day. Efficiency was valued more highly than background. Formally, Gulberg was subordinate to a line of police in the hierarchy under the head of Secretariat of the Security Police, to whom he had to deliver monthly reports. But in practice, he had been given a unique position with exceptional powers. He, and he alone, could decide to put Seppo's top bosses under the microscope. If he wanted to, he could even turn Per Gunnar Winger's life inside out, which he also did. He could initiate his own investigations, or carry out telephone tapping without having to justify his objective or even report it to a higher level. His model was the legendary James Jesus Angleton, who had a similar position in the CIA and whom he came to know personally. The section became a micro-organization within the division, outside, above, and parallel to the rest of the security police. This also had geographical consequences. The section had its offices at Kungsholmen, but for security reasons almost the whole team was moved out of police headquarters to an 11-room apartment in Östermalm that had been discreetly remodeled into a fortified office. It was staffed 24 hours a day, since the faithful old retainer and secretary Eleanor Badenbrink was installed in permanent lodgings in two of its rooms closest to the entrance. Badenbrink was an implacable colleague in whom Gulberg had implicit trust. In the organization, Gulberg and his employees disappeared from public view. They were financed through a special fund, but they did not exist anywhere in the formal structure of the security police, which reported to the police commission or the Justice Department. Not even the head of SIS knew about the most secret of the secret, whose task it was to handle the most sensitive of the sensitive. At the age of 40, Gulberg consequently found himself in a situation where he did not have to explain his actions to any living soul, and could initiate investigations of anyone he chose. It was clear to Gulberg that the section for special analysis could become a politically sensitive unit, and the job description was expressly vague. The written record was meagre in the extreme. In September 1964, Prime Minister Erlander signed a directive that guaranteed the setting aside of funds for the section for special analysis, which was understood to be essential to the nation's security. This was one of 12 similar matters which the assistant chief of SIS, Hans Wilhelm Franke, brought up during an afternoon meeting. The document was stamped top secret and filed in the special protocol of SIS. The signature of the Prime Minister meant that the section was now a legally approved institution. The first year's budget amounted to 52,000 kroner. That the budget was so low was a stroke of genius, Gulberg thought. It meant that the creation of the section appeared to be just another routine matter. In a broader sense, the signature of the Prime Minister meant that he had sanctioned the need for a unit that would be responsible for internal personnel control. At the same time, it could be interpreted as the Prime Minister giving his approval to the establishment of a body that would also monitor particularly sensitive individuals outside SIS, such as the Prime Minister himself. It was this last which created potentially acute political problems. Evert Gulberg saw that his whiskey glass was empty. He was not fond of alcohol, but it had been a long day and a long journey. At this stage of life, he did not think it mattered whether he decided to have one glass of whiskey or two. He poured himself the miniature Glenfiddich. The most sensitive of all issues, of course, was Olof Palme. Gulberg remembered every detail of Election Day 1976. For the first time in modern history, Sweden had voted for a conservative government. Most regrettably, it was Thorbjörn Fälldin who became Prime Minister, not Gustav Bohman, a man infinitely better qualified. But above all, Palme was defeated, and for that Gulberg could breathe a sigh of relief. Palme's stability as Prime Minister had been the object of more than one lunch conversation in the halls of SIS. In 1969, Winger had been dismissed from the service after he gave voice to the view, shared by many inside the division, that Palmer might be an agent of influence for the KGB. Winger's view was not even controversial in the climate prevailing inside the firm. Unfortunately, he had openly discussed the matter with County Governor Lassananti on a visit to Norrbotten. Lassananti had been astonished and had informed the government chancellor, with the result that Winger was summoned to explain himself at a one-on-one meeting. To Goldberg's frustration, the question of Palmer's possible Russian contacts was never resolved. Despite persistent attempts to establish the truth and uncover the crucial evidence, the smoking gun, the section had never found any proof. In Goldberg's eyes, this did not mean that Palmer was innocent, but rather that he was an especially cunning and intelligent spy who was not tempted to make the same mistakes that other Soviet spies had made. Palmer continued to baffle them, year after year. In 1982, the Palmer question arose again when he became Prime Minister for the second time. Then the assassin's shots rang out on Sveavägen, and the matter became irrelevant. 1976 had been a problematic year for the section. Within SIS, among the few people who actually knew about the existence of the section, a certain amount of criticism had surfaced. During the past 10 years, 65 employees from within the security police had been dismissed from the organisation on the grounds of presumed political unreliability. Most of the cases, however, could never be proven, and some senior officers began to wonder whether the section was run by paranoid conspiracy theorists. Goldberg still raged to recall the case of an officer hired by SIS in 1968, whom he had personally evaluated as unsuitable. He was Inspector Bergling, a lieutenant in the Swedish Army who later turned out to be a colonel in the Soviet Military Intelligence Service, the GRU. On 4 separate occasions, Goldberg tried to have Bergling removed, but each time his efforts were stymied. Things did not change until 1977, when Bergling became the object of suspicion outside the section as well. His became the worst scandal in the history of the Swedish security police. Criticism of the section had increased during the first half of the 70s, and by mid-decade Goldberg had heard several proposals that the budget be reduced, and even suggestions that the operation was altogether unnecessary. The criticism meant that the section's future was questioned. That year, the threat of terrorism was made a priority in SIS. In terms of espionage, it was a sad chapter in their history, dealing as they were mainly with confused youths, flirting with Arab or pro-Palestinian elements. The big question within the security police was to what extent personnel control would be given special authority to investigate foreign citizens residing in Sweden, or whether this would continue to be the exclusive domain of the Immigration Division. Out of this somewhat esoteric bureaucratic debate, a need had arisen for the section to assign a trusted colleague to the operation who could reinforce its control. Espionage, in fact, against members of the Immigration Division. The job fell to a young man who had worked at SIS since 1970, and whose background and political loyalty made him eminently qualified to work alongside the officers in the section. In his free time, he was a member of an organisation called the Democratic Alliance, which was described by the social democratic media as extremely right-wing. Within the section, this was no obstacle. 3 others were members of the Democratic Alliance too, and the section had in fact been instrumental in the formation of the group. It had also contributed a small part of its funding. It was through this organisation that the young man was brought to the attention of the section and recruited. His name was Gunnar Björk. It was an improbable stroke of luck that when Alexander Zalachenko walked into Norrmalm police station on election day 1976 and requested asylum, it was a junior officer named Gunnar Björk who received him in his capacity as administrator of the Immigration Division, an agent already connected to the most secret of the secret. Björk recognized Zalachenko's importance at once and broke off the interview to install the defector in a room at the Hotel Continental. It was Goldberg whom Björk notified when he sounded the alarm, and not his formal boss in the Immigration Division. The call came just as the voting booths had closed, and all signs pointed to the fact that Palmer was going to lose. Goldberg had just come home and was watching the election coverage on TV. At first he was sceptical about the information that the excited young officer was telling him, Then he drove down to the Continental, not 250 yards from the hotel room where he found himself today, to assume control of the Zalachenko affair. That night, Gulberg's life underwent a radical change. The notion of secrecy took on a whole new dimension. He saw immediately the need to create a new structure around the defector. He decided to include Björk in the Zalachenko unit. It was a reasonable decision, since Björk already knew of Zalachenko's existence. Better to have him on the inside than a security risk on the outside. Björk was moved from his post within the Immigration Division to a desk in the apartment in Östermalm. In the drama that followed, Gulberg chose from the beginning to inform only one person in SIS, namely the head of Secretariat, who already had an overview of the activities of the section. The head of Secretariat sat on the news for several days, before he explained to Gulberg that the defection was so big that the chief of SIS would have to be informed, as well as the government. By that time, the new chief of SIS knew about the section for special analysis, but he had only a vague idea of what the section actually did. He had come on board recently to clean up the shambles of what was known as the Internal Bureau affair, and was already on his way to a higher position within the police hierarchy. The chief of SIS had been told in a private conversation with the head of Secretariat that the section was a secret unit appointed by the government. Its mandate put it outside regular operations, and no questions should be asked. Since this particular chief was a man who never asked questions that might yield unpleasant answers, he acquiesced. He accepted that there was something known only as SSA, and that he should have nothing more to do with the matter. Gulberg was willing to accept this situation. He issued instructions that required even the chief of SIS not to discuss the topic in his office without taking special precautions. It was agreed that Zalachenko would be handled by the Section for Special Analysis. The outgoing Prime Minister was certainly not to be informed. Because of the merry-go-round associated with a change of government, the incoming Prime Minister was fully occupied appointing ministers and negotiating with other Conservative parties. It was not until a month after the government was formed that the chief of SIS, along with Gulberg, drove to Rosenbad to inform the incoming Prime Minister. Gulberg had objected to telling the government at all, but the chief of SIS had stood his ground. It was constitutionally indefensible not to inform the Prime Minister. Gulberg used all his eloquence to convince the Prime Minister not to allow information about Zalachenko to pass beyond his own office. There was, he insisted, no need for the Foreign Minister, the Minister of Defence, or any other member of the government to be informed. It had upset Feldin that an important Soviet agent had sought asylum in Sweden. The Prime Minister had begun to talk about how, for the sake of fairness, he would be obliged to take up the matter at least with the leaders of the other two parties in the coalition government. Gulberg was expecting this objection, and played the strongest card he had available. He explained in a low voice that if that happened, he would be forced to tender his resignation immediately. This was a threat that made an impression on Feldin. It was intended to convey that the Prime Minister would bear the responsibility if the story ever got out, and the Russians sent a death squad to liquidate Zalachenko. And if the person responsible for Zalachenko's safety had seen fit to resign, such a revelation would be a political disaster for the Prime Minister. Feldin, still relatively unsure in his role, had acquiesced. He approved a directive that was immediately entered into the secret protocol, making the section responsible for Zalachenko's safety and debriefing. It also laid down that information about Zalachenko would not leave the Prime Minister's office. By signing this directive, Feldin had in practice demonstrated that he had been informed, but it also prevented him from ever discussing the matter. In short, he could forget about Zalachenko. But Feldin had required that one person in his office, a hand-picked state secretary, also be informed. He would function as a contact person in matters relating to the defector. Gulberg allowed himself to agree to this. He did not anticipate having any problem handling a state secretary. The chief of SIS was pleased. The Zalachenko matter was now constitutionally secured, which in this case meant that the chief had covered his back. Gulberg was pleased as well. He had managed to create a quarantine, which meant that he would be able to control the flow of information. He alone controlled Zalachenko. When he got back to Östermalm, he sat at his desk and wrote down a list of the people who knew about Zalachenko. Himself, Björk, the operations chief of the section, Hans von Röttinger, assistant chief Frederick Clinton, the section's secretary, Eleanor Badenbrink, and two officers whose job it was to compile and analyze any intelligence information that Zalichenko might contribute. Seven individuals, who over the coming years would constitute a special section within the section. He thought of them as the inner circle. Outside the section, the information was known by the chief of SIS, the assistant chief, and the head of secretariat. Besides them, the prime minister and a state secretary. A total of 12. Never before had a secret of this magnitude been known to such a very small group. Then Gulberg's expression darkened. The secret was known also to a 13th person. Bjork had been accompanied at Zalichenko's original reception by a lawyer, Niels Erik Bjurman. To include Bjurman in the special section would be out of the question. Bjurman was not a real security policeman. He was really no more than a trainee at SIS, and he did not have the requisite experience or skills. Gulberg considered various alternatives and then chose to steer Bjurman carefully out of the picture. He used the threat of imprisonment for life, for treason, if Bjurman were to breathe so much as one syllable about Zalichenko, and at the same time he offered inducements, promises of future assignments, and finally he used flattery to bolster Bjurman's feeling of importance. He arranged for Bjurman to be hired by a well-regarded law firm, which then provided him with a steady stream of assignments to keep him busy. The only problem was that Bjurman was such a mediocre lawyer that he was hardly capable of exploiting his opportunities. He left the firm after 10 years and opened his own practice, which eventually became a law office at Odenplan. Over the following years, Gulberg kept Bjurman under discreet but regular surveillance. That was Bjork's job. It was not until the end of the 80s that he stopped monitoring Bjurman, at which time the Soviet Union was heading for collapse and Zalichenko had ceased to be a priority. For the section, Zalichenko had at first been thought of as a potential breakthrough in the Palmer mystery. Palmer had accordingly been one of the first subjects that Gulberg discussed with him during the long debriefing. The hopes for a breakthrough, however, were soon dashed, since Zalichenko had never operated in Sweden and had little knowledge of the country. On the other hand, Zalichenko had heard the rumour of a red jumper, a highly placed Swede or possibly other Scandinavian politician who worked for the KGB. Gulberg drew up a list of names that were connected to Palme: Carl Lidbom, Pierre Skori, Sten Andersson, Marita Ulfskog, and a number of others. For the rest of his life, Gulberg would come back again and again to that list, but he never found an answer. Gulberg was suddenly a big player. He was welcomed with respect in the exclusive club of selected warriors, all known to one another, where the contacts were made through personal friendship and trust, not through official channels and bureaucratic regulations. He met James Jesus Angleton, and he got to drink whiskey at a discreet club in London with the chief of MI6. He was one of the elite. He was never going to be able to tell anyone about his triumphs, not even in posthumous memoirs. And there was the ever-present anxiety that the enemy would notice his overseas journeys, that he might attract attention, that he might involuntarily lead the Russians to Zalichenko. In that respect, Zalichenko was his worst enemy. During the first year, the defector had lived in an anonymous apartment owned by the section. He did not exist in any registry or in any public document. Those within the Zalichenko unit thought they had plenty of time before they had to plan his future. Not until the spring of 1978 was he given a passport in the name of Carl Axel Bodin, along with a laboriously crafted personal history, a fictitious but verifiable background in Swedish records. By that time it was already too late. Zalichenko had gone and fucked that stupid whore Agneta Sofia Salander, nay, Sjölander, and he had heedlessly told her his real name, Zalichenko. Gulberg began to believe that Zalichenko was not quite right in the head. He suspected that the Russian defector wanted to be exposed. It was as if he needed a platform. How else to explain the fact that he had been so fucking stupid? There were whores, there were periods of excessive drinking, and there were incidents of violence with bouncers and others. On 3 occasions, Zalichenko was arrested by the Swedish police for drunkenness, and twice more in connection with fights in bars. every time the section had to intervene discreetly and bail him out, seeing to it that documents disappeared and records were altered. Goldberg assigned Björk to babysit the defector almost around the clock. It was not an easy job, but there was no alternative. Everything could have gone fine. By the early 80s, Zalachenko had calmed down and begun to adapt, but he never gave up the whore Salander. And worse, he had become the father of Camilla and Lisbeth Salander. Lisbeth Salander. Goldberg pronounced the name with displeasure. Ever since the girls were 9 or 10, he had had a bad feeling about Lisbeth. He did not need a psychiatrist to tell him that she was not normal. Björk had reported that she was vicious and aggressive towards her father, and that she seemed to be not in the least afraid of him. She did not say much, but she expressed her dissatisfaction in 1,000 other ways. She was a problem in the making, but how gigantic this problem would become was something Goldberg could never have imagined in his wildest dreams. What he most feared was that the situation in the Salander family would give rise to a social welfare report that named Zalachenko. Time and again he urged the man to cut his ties and disappear from their lives. Zalachenko would give his word, and then would always break it. He had other whores. He had plenty of whores. But after a few months, he was always back with a Salander woman. That blasted Zalachenko. An intelligence agent who let his cock rule any part of his life was obviously not a good intelligence agent. It was as though the man thought himself above all normal rules. If he could have screwed the whore without beating her up every time, that would have been one thing. But Zalachenko was guilty of repeated assault against his girlfriend. He seemed to find it amusing to beat her just to provoke his babysitters in the Zalachenko group. Goldberg had no doubt that Zalachenko was a sick fuck, but he was in no position to pick and choose among defecting GRU agents. He had only one, a man very aware of his value to Goldberg. The Zalachenko unit had taken on the role of clean-up patrol. It was undeniable. Zalachenko knew that he could take liberties, and that the unit would resolve whatever problems there might be. When it came to Agneta Sofia Salander, he exploited his hold over them to the maximum. Not that there weren't warnings. When Salander was 12, she stabbed Zalachenko. His wounds had not been life-threatening, but he was taken to St. Goran's Hospital and the group had more of a mop-up job to do than ever. Goldberg then made it crystal clear to Zalachenko that he must never have any more dealings with the Salander family, and Zalachenko had promised. A promise he kept for more than 6 months. Before he turned up at Agneta Sofia Salander's place and beat her so savagely that she ended up in a nursing home for the rest of her life. But Goldberg had not foreseen that the Salander girl would go so far as to make a Molotov cocktail. That day had been utter chaos. All manner of investigations loomed, and the future of the Zalachenko unit, of the whole section even, had hung by a thread. If Salander talked, Zalachenko's cover was at risk. And if that were to happen, a number of operations put in place over Europe over the past 15 years might have to be dismantled. Furthermore, there was a possibility that the section would be subjected to official scrutiny, and that had to be prevented at all costs. Goldberg had been consumed with worry. If the section's archives were opened, a number of practices would be revealed that were not always consistent with the dictates of the Constitution, not to mention their years of investigations of Palmer and other prominent social democrats. Just a few years after Palmer's assassination, that was still a sensitive issue. Prosecution of Goldberg and several other employees of the section would inevitably follow. Even worse, some ambitious journalist would float the theory that the section was behind the assassination of Palmer, and that in turn would lead to even more damaging speculation and investigation. The most worrying aspect of all this was that the command of the security police had changed so much that not even the overall chief of SIS now knew about the existence of the section. All contacts with SIS stopped at the desk of the new assistant chief of secretariat. And he had been on the staff of the section for 10 years. A mood of acute panic, even fear, overtook the unit. It was, in fact, Björk who proposed the solution. Peter Teleborian, a psychiatrist, had become associated with SIS's Department of Counter-Espionage in a different case. He had been key as a consultant in connection with counter-espionage's surveillance of a suspected industrial spy. at a critical stage of the investigation, they needed to know how the person in question might react if subjected to a great deal of stress. Caliborian had offered concrete advice, and SIS had succeeded in averting a suicide, managing to turn the spy in question into a double agent. After Salander's attack on Zalachenko, Bjork had surreptitiously engaged Teleborian as an outside consultant to the section. The solution to the problem had been very simple. Carl Axel Bodin would disappear into rehabilitative custody. Agneta Sophia Salander would necessarily disappear into an institution for long-term care. All the police reports on the case were collected at SIS and transferred by way of the assistant head of secretariat to the section. Teleborian was assistant head physician at St. Stephen's Psychiatric Clinic for Children in Uppsala. All that was needed was a legal psychiatric report, which Björk and Teleborian drafted together, and then a brief and, as it turned out, uncontested decision in a district court. It was a question only of how the case was presented. The Constitution had nothing to do with it. It was, after all, a matter of national security. Besides, Salander was obviously insane. A few years in an institution would do her nothing but good. Goldberg had approved the operation. This solution to their multiple problems presented itself at a time when the Zalachenko unit was on its way to being dissolved. The Soviet Union had ceased to exist, and Zalachenko's usefulness was definitively a thing of the past. The unit procured a generous severance package from security police funds. They arranged for him to have the best rehabilitative care, and after 6 months, they put him on a flight to Spain. From that moment on, they made it clear to Zalachenko that he and the section were going their separate ways. It had been one of Gulberg's last responsibilities. 1 week later, he reached retirement age and handed the reins to his chosen successor, Frederick Clinton. Thereafter, Gulberg acted only as an advisor in especially sensitive matters. He stayed in Stockholm for another 3 years and worked almost daily at the section, but the number of his assignments decreased and gradually he disengaged himself. He then returned to his hometown of Laholm and did some work from there. At first he had travelled frequently to Stockholm, but he made these journeys less and less often, and eventually not at all. He had not even thought about Zalachenko for months, until the morning he discovered the daughter in every newspaper headline. Gulberg followed the story in a state of bewilderment. It was no accident, of course, that Bjurman had been Salander's guardian. On the other hand, he couldn't see why the old Zalachenko story should surface. Salander was obviously deranged, so it was no surprise that she had killed these people, but that Zalachenko might have any connection to the affair had not dawned on him. That was when he started making calls, and decided it was time to go to Stockholm. The section was faced with its worst crisis since the day he had created it. Zalachenko dragged himself to the toilet. Now that he had crutches, he could move around his room. On Sunday, he forced himself through short, sharp training sessions. The pain in his jaw was still excruciating, and he could manage only liquid food, but he could get out of his bed and begin to cover small distances. Having lived so long with a prosthesis, he was used to crutches. He practiced moving noiselessly on them, manoeuvring back and forth around his bed. Every time his right foot touched the floor, a terrible pain shot up his leg. He gritted his teeth. He thought about the fact that his daughter was very close by. It had taken him all day to work out that her room was 2 doors down the corridor to the right. The night nurse had been gone 10 minutes. Everything was quiet. It was 2 in the morning. Zalachenko laboriously got up and fumbled for his crutches. He listened at the door but heard nothing. He pulled open the door and went into the corridor. He heard faint music from the nurse's station. He made his way to the end of the corridor, pushed open the door, and looked into the empty landing where the elevators were. Going back down the corridor, he stopped at the door to his daughter's room and rested there on his crutches for 30 minutes, listening. Salander opened her eyes when she heard a scraping sound. It was as though someone was dragging something along the corridor. For a moment there was only silence, and she wondered if she was imagining things. Then she heard the same sound again, moving away. Her uneasiness grew. Zalachenko was out there somewhere. She felt fettered to her bed. Her skin itched under the neck brace. She felt an intense desire to move, to get up. Gradually she succeeded in sitting up. That was all she could manage. She sank back onto the pillow. She ran her hand over her neck brace and located the fastenings that held it in place. She opened them and dropped the brace to the floor. Immediately it was easier to breathe. What she wanted more than anything was a weapon, and to have the strength to get up and finish the job once and for all. With difficulty she propped herself up, switched on the nightlight, and looked around the room. She could see nothing that would serve her purpose. Then her eyes fell on a nurse's table on the wall across from her bed. Someone had left a pencil there. She waited until the night nurse had come and gone, which tonight she seemed to be doing about every half hour. Presumably the reduced frequency of the nurse's visits meant that the doctors had decided her condition had improved. Over the weekend, the nurses had checked on her at least once every 10 minutes. She could hardly notice any difference herself. When she was alone, she gathered her strength, sat up, and swung her legs over the side of the bed. She had electrodes taped to her body to record her pulse and breathing, but the wires stretched in the direction of the pencil. She put her weight on her feet and stood up. Suddenly she swayed, off balance. For a second she felt as though she would faint, but she steadied herself against the bed and concentrated her gaze on the table in front of her. She took small, wobbly steps, reached out and grabbed the pencil. Then she retreated slowly to the bed. She was exhausted. After a while she managed to pull the sheet and blanket up to her chin. She studied the pencil. It was a plain wooden pencil, newly sharpened. It would make a passable weapon for stabbing a face or an eye. She laid it next to her hip and fell asleep.
Chapter 6. Monday, April 11th. Blomqvist got up just after 9 and called Ericsson at Millennium.
"Good morning, Editor-in-Chief," he said.
"I'm still in shock that Erika is gone, and you want me to take her place. Her office is empty."
"Then it would probably be a good idea to spend the day moving in there."
"I feel extremely self-conscious."
"Don't be. Everyone agrees that you're the best choice, and if need be, you can always come to me or Krista."
"Thank you for your trust in me."
"You've earned it," Blomqvist said. "Just keep working the way you always do. We'll deal with any problems as and when they crop up." He told her he was going to be at home all day writing. Ericsson realized that he was reporting into her the way he had with Berger.
"Okay. Is there anything you want us to do?"
"No. On the contrary. If you have any instructions for me, just call. I'm still on the Salander story, trying to find out what's happening there. But for everything else to do with the magazine, the ball's in your court. You make the decisions. You'll have my support if you need it."
"And what if I make a wrong decision?"
"If I see or hear anything out of the ordinary, we'll talk it through. But it would have to be something very unusual. Generally, there aren't any decisions that are 100% right or wrong. You'll make your decisions, and they might not be the same ones Erika would have made, or even that I would have made. But your decisions are the ones that count."
"All right."
"If you're a good boss, then you'll discuss any concerns with the others. First with Henry and Krista, then with me. And we'll raise any problems at the editorial meetings."
"I'll do my best."
"Good luck." He sat down on the sofa in the living room with his iBook on his lap and worked without any breaks all day. When he was finished, he had a rough draft of 2 articles, totaling 21 pages, focused on the deaths of Svensson and Johansson. What they were working on, why they were killed, and who the killer was. He estimated that he would have to produce twice as much text again for the summer issue. He also had to resolve how to profile Salander in the article without violating her trust. He knew things about her that she would never want published. Gulberg had a single slice of bread and a cup of black coffee in Frey's Café. Then he took a taxi to Artillerigatan in Östermalm. At 9:15 he introduced himself on the entryphone and was buzzed inside. He took the elevator to the 7th floor, where he was received by Birger Wadenschuh, the new chief of the section. Wadenschuh had been one of the latest recruits to the section around the time Gulberg retired. He wished that the decisive Frederick was still there. Clinton had succeeded Gulberg and was the chief of the section until 2002, when diabetes and coronary artery disease had forced him into retirement. Gulberg did not have a clear sense of what Wadenschuh was made of.
"Welcome, Evett," Wadenschuh said, shaking hands with his former chief. "It's good of you to take the time to come in." "Time is more or less all I have," Goldberg said.
"You know how it goes. I wish we had the leisure to stay in touch with faithful old colleagues."
Goldberg ignored the insinuation. He turned left into his old office and sat at the round conference table by the window. He assumed it was Vardenshaw who was responsible for the Chagall and Mondrian reproductions. In his day, plans of the warships Cronan and Vasa had hung on the walls. He had always dreamed about the sea, and he was in fact a naval officer, although he had spent only a few brief months at sea during his military service. There were computers now, but otherwise the room looked almost exactly as when he had left. Vardenshaw poured coffee.
"The others are on their way," he said. "I thought we could have a few words first."
"How many in the section are still here from my day?"
"Apart from me, only Otto Hallberg and Georg Nystrom. Hallberg is retiring this year and Nystrom is turning 60. Otherwise it's new recruits. You've probably met some of them before."
"How many are working for the section today?"
"We've reorganized a bit."
"And?"
"There are 7 full-timers, so we've cut back. But there's a total of 31 employees of the section within SIS. Most of them never come here. They take care of their normal jobs and do some discreet moonlighting for us should the need or opportunity arise."
31 employees.
"Plus the 7 here. You were the one who created the system, after all. We've just fine-tuned it. Today we have what's called an internal and external organization. When we recruit somebody, they're given a leave of absence for a time to go to our school. Hallberg is in charge of training, which is 6 weeks for the basics. We do it out at the naval school. Then they go back to their regular jobs in SIS, but now they work for us."
"I see."
"It's an excellent system. Most of our employees have no idea of the other's existence. And here in the section we function principally as report recipients. The same rules apply as in your day. We have to be a single-level organization."
"Do you have an operations unit?"
Vardenshaw frowned. In Goldberg's day the section had a small operations unit, consisting of 4 people under the command of the shrewd Hans von Rottinger.
"Well, not exactly. Von Rottinger died 5 years ago. We have a younger talent who does some field work, but usually we use someone from the external organization if necessary. Of course, things have become more complicated technically, for example, when we need to arrange a telephone tap or enter an apartment. Nowadays there are alarms and other devices everywhere."
Goldberg nodded.
"Budget?"
"About 11 million a year total. A third goes to salaries, a third to overheads, and a third to operations."
"The budget has shrunk."
"A little, but we have fewer people, which means that the operations budget has actually increased."
"Tell me about our relationship to SIS.
Vardenshaw shook his head.
"The chief of secretariat and the chief of budget belong to us. Formally, the chief of secretariat is the only one who has insight into our activities. We are so secret that we don't exist. But in practice, 2 assistant chiefs know of our existence. They do their best to ignore anything they hear about us."
"Which means that if problems arise, the present SIS leadership will have an unpleasant surprise. What about the defence leadership and the government?"
"We cut off the defence leadership some 10 years ago, and governments come and go."
"So if the shit hits the fan, we're on our own?"
Vardenshaw nodded.
"That's the drawback with this arrangement. The advantages are obvious, but our assignments have also changed. There's a new realpolitik in Europe since the Soviet Union collapsed. Our work is less and less about identifying spies. It's about terrorism and about evaluating the political suitability of individuals in sensitive positions."
"That's what it was always about."
There was a knock at the door. Goldberg looked up to see a smartly dressed man of about 60, and a younger man in jeans and a tweed jacket.
"Come in. Evert Goldberg, this is Jonas Sandberg. He's been working here for 4 years and is in charge of operations. He's the one I told you about. And Georg Nystrom, you know."
"Hello, Georg,"
Goldberg said.
They all shook hands. Then Goldberg turned to Sandberg.
"So where do you come from?"
"Most recently from Göteborg," Sandberg said lightly. "I went to see him."
"Zalachenko?"
Sandberg nodded.
"Have a seat, gentlemen," Vardenshaw said.
"Björk,"
Goldberg said, frowning when Vardenshaw lit a cigarillo. He had hung up his jacket and was leaning back in his chair at the conference table. Vardenshaw glanced at Goldberg and was struck by how thin the old man had become.
"He was arrested for violation of the prostitution laws last Friday," Nystrom said. "The matter has gone to court, but in effect he confessed and slunk home with his tail between his legs. He lives out in Smodelaru,
but he's on disability leave. The press hasn't picked up on it yet.
He was once one of the very best we had here in the section, Wilberg said. He played a key role in the Zalichenko affair. What's happened to him since I retired?
Bjork is probably one of the very few internal colleagues who left the section and went back to external operations. He was out flitting around even in your day.
Well, I do recall he needed a little rest and wanted to expand his horizons. He was on leave of absence from the section for 2 years in the '80s when he worked as intelligence attaché. He had worked like a fiend with Zalichenko, practically around the clock from 1976 on, and I thought he needed a break. He was gone from 1985 to 1987 when he came back here.
You could say that he quit the section in 1994 when he went over to the external organization. In 1996 he became assistant chief of the immigration division and ended up in a stressful position. His official duties took up a great deal of his time. Naturally, he stayed in contact with the section throughout, and we had conversations with him about once a month until recently.
He's ill?
It's nothing serious, but very painful. He has a slipped disc. He's had recurring trouble with it over the past few years. 2 years ago, he was on sick leave for 4 months. Then he was taken ill again in August last year. He was supposed to start work again in January, but his sick leave was extended, and now it's a question of waiting for an operation.
And he spent his sick leave running around with prostitutes? Goldberg said.
Yes, he's not married, and his dealings with whores appear to have been going on for many years, if I've understood correctly, said Sandberg, who had been silent for almost half an hour. I've read Dag Svensson's manuscript.
I see. But can anyone explain to me what actually happened?
As far as we can tell, it was Bjork who initiated this whole mess. How else can we explain the report from 1991, ending up in the hands of Advocate Bierman?
Another man who spends his time with prostitutes? Goldberg said.
Not as far as we know, and he wasn't mentioned in Svensson's material. He was, however, Lisbeth Salander's guardian.
Vardenshaw sighed.
You could say it was my fault. You and Bjork arrested Salander in 1991 when she was sent to the psychiatric hospital. We expected her to be away for much longer, but she became acquainted with a lawyer, Holger Palmgren, who managed to spring her loose. She was then placed with a foster family. By that time you had retired.
And then what happened?
We kept an eye on her. In the meantime, her twin sister, Camilla, was placed in a foster home in Uppsala. When they were 17, Lisbeth started digging into her past. She was looking for Zalichenko, and she went through every public registry she could find. Somehow, we're not sure how it happened, she came to the conclusion that her sister knew where Zalichenko was.
Was it true?
Vardenshaw shrugged.
I have no idea. The sisters had not seen each other for several years when Lisbeth Salander confronted Camilla and tried to persuade her to tell her what she knew. It ended in a violent argument and a spectacular fight between the sisters.
Then what?
We kept close track of Lisbeth during those months. We had also informed Camilla that her sister was violent and mentally ill. She was the one who got in touch with us after Lisbeth's unexpected visit, and thereafter we increased our surveillance of her.
The sister was your informant?
Camilla was mortally afraid of her sister. Lisbeth had aroused attention in other quarters as well. She had several run-ins with people from the Social Welfare Agency, and in our estimation she still represented a threat to Zalichenko's anonymity. Then there was the incident in the Tunnelbana.
She attacked a pedophile?
Precisely. She was obviously prone to violence and mentally disturbed. We thought that it would be best for all concerned if she disappeared into some institution again and availed herself of the opportunities there, so to speak. Clinton and von Rottinger were the ones who took the lead. They engaged the psychiatrist Teleborian again, and, through a representative, filed a request in the district court to get her institutionalized for a second time. Palmgren stood up for Salander, and against all odds the court decided to follow his recommendation, so long as she was placed under guardianship.
But how did Bjorman get involved?
Palmgren had a stroke in the fall of 2002. We still flag Salander for monitoring whenever she turns up in any database, and I saw to it that Bjorman became her new guardian. Bear in mind that he had no clue she was Zalichenko's daughter. The brief was simply for Bjorman to sound the alarm if she started blabbing about Zalichenko.
Bjorman was an idiot. He should never have been allowed to have anything to do with Zalichenko, even less with his daughter.
Goldberg looked at Vardenshaw.
That was a serious mistake.
I know, Vardenshaw said. But he seemed the right choice at the time. I never would have dreamed that...
Where's the sister today? Camilla Salander?
We don't know. When she was 19, she packed her bag and ran away from her foster family. We haven't heard a peep out of her since.
Go on.
I have a man in the regular police who has spoken with Prosecutor Ekstrom, Sandberg said. The officer running the investigation, Inspector Bublansky, thinks that Bjurman raped Salander. Gulberg looked at Sandberg with astonishment.
Raped her?
He said. Bjurman had a tattoo across his belly which read, I am a sadistic pig, a pervert, and a rapist. Sandberg put a colour photograph from the autopsy on the table. Gulberg stared at it with distaste.
Zalachenko's daughter is supposed to have given him that.
It's hard to find another explanation. And she's not known for being a shrinking violet. She kicked the shit out of two thugs from Svavelshire MC.
Zalachenko's daughter, Gulberg repeated.
He turned to Vardenshaw.
You know what? I think you ought to recruit her for the section.
Vardenshaw looked so startled that Gulberg had to explain that he was joking.
Okay. Let's take it as a working hypothesis that Bjurman raped her and she somehow took her revenge. What else?
The only one who could tell us exactly what happened, of course, is Bjurman, and he's dead. But the thing is, he shouldn't have had a clue that she was Zalachenko's daughter. It's not in any public records. But somehow, somewhere along the way, Bjurman discovered the connection.
But God damn it, Vardenshaw, she knew who her father was and could have told Bjurman at any time.
I know. I simply wasn't thinking straight.
That is unforgivably incompetent, Gulberg said.
I've kicked myself 100 times about it. But Bjurman was one of the very few people who knew of Zalachenko's existence, and my thought was that it would be better if he, rather than some other unknown guardian, discovered she was Zalachenko's daughter. She could have told anyone. Gulberg pulled on his earlobe.
All right. Continue.
It's all hypothetical, Nystrom said, but our supposition is that Bjurman assaulted Salander and that she struck back and did that. He pointed at the tattoo in the autopsy photograph.
Her father's daughter, Gulberg said.
There was more than a trace of admiration in his voice. With the result that Bjurman made contact with Zalachenko, hoping to get rid of the daughter. As we know, Zalachenko had good reason to hate the girl, and he gave the contract to Svavelshire MC and this Niedermann that he hangs out with.
But how did Bjurman get in touch?
Gulberg fell silent. The answer was obvious. Bjork, Vardenshaw said. Bjork gave him the contact.
Damn,
Gulberg said. In the morning, two nurses came to change her bed linen. They found the pencil. Oops, how did this get here? One of them said, putting the pencil in her pocket. Salander looked at her with murder in her eyes. She was once more without a weapon, but she was too weak to protest. Her headache was unbearable, and she was given strong painkillers. Her left shoulder stabbed like a knife if she moved carelessly or tried to shift her weight. She lay on her back with a brace around her neck. It was supposed to be left on for a few more days until the wound in her head began to heal. This morning she had a temperature of 102. Dr. Endrin could tell that there was an infection. Salander didn't need a thermometer to work that out. She realized that once again she was confined to an institutional bed, even though this time there was no strap holding her down. That would have been unnecessary. She couldn't sit up, let alone leave the room. At lunchtime on Monday, she had a visit from Dr. Jonasson.
Hello.
Do you remember me? She shook her head. I was the one who woke you after surgery. I operated on you. I just wanted to hear how you're doing and if everything is going well. Salander looked at him, her eyes wide. It should have been obvious that everything was not going well.
I heard you took off your neck brace last night.
She acknowledged as much with her eyes.
We put the neck brace on for a reason. You have to keep your head still for the healing process to get started.
He looked at the silent girl. Okay, he said at last. I just wanted to check on you. He was at the door when he heard her voice.
It's Jonasson, right?
He turned and smiled at her in surprise.
That's right. If you remember my name, then you must have been more alert than I thought.
And you were the one who operated to remove the bullet?
That's right.
Please tell me how I'm doing. I can't get a sensible answer from anyone.
He went back to her bedside and looked her in the eye. You were lucky. You were shot in the head, but the bullet did not, I believe, injure any vital areas. And the risk is that you could have bleeding in your brain. That's why we want you to stay still. You also have an infection. The wound in your shoulder seems to be the cause. It's possible that you'll need another operation on your shoulder if we can't arrest the infection with antibiotics. You're going to have some painful times ahead while your body heals, but as things look now, I'm optimistic that you'll make a full recovery.
Can this cause brain damage?
He hesitated before nodding. Yes, there is that possibility. But all signs indicate that you made it through fine. There's also a possibility that you'll develop scar tissue in your brain, which might cause trouble. For instance, you might develop epilepsy or some other problem. But, to be honest, it's all speculation. Right now things look good. You're healing. And if problems crop up along the way, we'll deal with them. Is that a clear enough answer? She shut her eyes to say yes.
How long do I have to lie here like this?
You mean in the hospital? It will be at least a couple of weeks before we can let you go.
No, I mean, how long before I can get up and start walking and moving around?
That depends on how the healing progresses, but count on 2 weeks before we can start you on some sort of physical therapy. She gave him a long look.
You wouldn't happen to have a cigarette, would you?
She said. Dr. Jonasson burst out laughing and shook his head. Sorry, there's no smoking allowed in the hospital. But I can see to it that you get a nicotine patch, or some gum. She thought for a moment before she looked at him again.
How's the old bastard doing?
Who?
You mean the one who came in the same time as I did?
No friend of yours, I presume. Well, he's going to survive, and he's been up walking around on crutches. He's actually in worse shape than you are, and he has a very painful facial wound. As I understand it, you've slammed an axe into his head.
He tried to kill me,
Salander said in a low voice. That doesn't sound good. I have to go. Do you want me to come back and look in on you again? Salander thought for a moment, then she signalled yes. When he was gone, she stared at the ceiling.
Zalachenko has been given crutches. That was the sound I heard last night.